sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear one of my favorite speeches from the Toronto hearings this past September. It's by Lance DeHaven Smith. And then I'm going to tell you about two events. So first for the speech. Lance DeHaven Smith is a professor at the Askew School of Public Administration and Policy at Florida State University. A former president of the Florida Political Science Association, he is the author, co-author, or editor of 15 books on topics ranging from religion and political philosophy to Florida government and politics. While at FSU, he has held a number of positions applying academic knowledge to problems of public policy. He served as associate director of the Florida Institute of Government, director of the Askew School, executive director of the Citizens Commission on Cabinet Reform, executive director of the Local Government Commission 2, executive director of the National Public Sector Gaming Study Commission. Mr. DeHaven's scholarship is nationally recognized. He's appeared on Good Morning America, The Today Show, NBC Nightly News with Tom Brokaw, CBS Nightly News with Dan Rather, The Jim Lehrer NewsHour, CNN, NPR, and other national TV and radio shows. Dr. DeHaven Smith was an infantry rifleman in the U.S. Army during the Vietnam era. He began his teaching career in 1981 as an assistant professor of political science at Florida Atlantic University. He joined Florida State University in 1994. He's had many recent publications and papers, two of which are Preventing State Crimes Against Democracy in 2009, which he wrote with Matthew T. Witt, and also When Political Crimes Are Inside Jobs, Detecting State Crimes Against Democracy, in 2006. He was also identified by Florida Trend magazine as one of Florida's 100 most influential people and 5 most influential scientists in November of 2004. The speech was taped live, so there are some imperfections to the sound quality. I hope you'll find that his message vastly outweighs these imperfections. In the speech, he refers to SCADs on several occasions, and SCADs are State Crimes Against Democracy. So here he is, Lance DeHaven Smith, at the Toronto hearings.
When somebody first told people the Earth is spinning and flying through space, what would you say if they said, why don't we fly off? What's the answer?
Gravity.
Gravity. Now, the person says, gravity. Now, can you show me this gravity? Where is it? Oh, it's invisible. Operates at a distance. I see. And I'm supposed to believe this thing exists. The only reason you have her even telling me about it is you think the Earth is spinning, which it obviously is not. So why do you need this concept? How did we come to understand gravity? Well, it was a simple experiment that was done. Galileo said that objects of different sizes and weights would fall at the same rate of acceleration. We had assumed that objects fell based on their weight. Heavier would fall faster. We were assuming the force that acted here was weight. And Galileo said, no, the force is a uniform force, the Earth's gravity. And it will operate the same on any weighted object, whether it's heavy or light. And he dropped these repeatedly, stood on the Leaning Tower of Pisa and dropped different sized cannonballs off the tower, and they landed at the same time. And people were stunned. They had seen things fall many times, all your life you'd see this, but they had always assumed that they fell at different speeds, and then when they were shown they didn't, it was an eye-opening experience. And that's, I think, how science works. The theory of evolution, you know, how did we get to this? This was a shocking idea when it was introduced, the idea that all life came from some simple organisms that evolved in, and it was insulting, you know, to say human beings evolved from apes. I mean, we had court cases in the United States in the 20th century about whether you could even teach that. So it was very insulting. How did we come to believe it? Well, one is Darwin showed us that if you look at animals in different environments, you see that they vary according to their environment. So if you look in a snowy area, you'll see the rabbits are white. If you go to the desert, you see that they're tan. So he showed us this over and over and over again. He also pointed to the fossil record. We had found fossils before. We didn't know what they were, though. And what Darwin said was, this is evidence of the evolutionary path. And we went and found intermediary species between apes and human beings. We found the fossil record. So that was another thing. It was something that once we knew to look, we could find, but until we thought about it, we didn't even notice. Darwin also told us there were things about ourselves that we could see evolution in. He would point out to audiences that, that most of us, if you feel behind the curve of your ear, there's a little indentation about a third of the way down. And that's, in monkeys, that's where their ear bends. And dogs have a crease in their ear the same kind of way. And Darwin said, well, see, you have that crease. You can't bend your ear, but you still have the crease, the sign of it. So he pointed out things that we could have seen, but we would have never known about without the theory. And I think that and my point is that's how science works. It takes things that you can't refute and brings them to your attention and changes the way you see the world all around. I think of it as having, there are two types of discoveries going on. One, I call macro discoveries. This is where you have this big picture and you find things that fill in the blanks. So you have this big picture that says humans evolved and everything evolved from different species, simpler species, and you go looking for intermediary species. And when you find those, that's a, I call it a macro discovery, like filling in the puzzle. Micro discoveries are where you take the big picture and you go zoom down on a narrow thing, and you see something you hadn't seen before. So you see the objects fall at the same rate of acceleration. You see the little ear indentation. I'm going to talk about these patterns among scads as a macro discovery. There's nothing super about it. It's really kind of silly that we've not looked for these before. They're pretty straightforward. And then I will talk about 9/11 as some things that we might draw from scads to look at there as micro discoveries. All right, let's talk about everyday perceptions of elite political crimes. They're viewed individually and in isolation. JFK, John Kennedy, and Robert Kennedy, both assassinated in the 60s. Both brothers, both assassinated while campaigning. Both shot in the head, which is actually kind of rare for assassinations. And most of the time they shoot you in the stomach, like Oswald, bigger target. But nobody looked at that as a serial crime. Nobody said, in fact, we don't say Kennedy assassinations. We say the Kennedy assassination. And what that means is President Kennedy. And if you want to talk specifically about Robert Kennedy's assassination, you have to say Robert Kennedy's assassination. We don't use the plural. Same with the 2000 and the 2004 election. Now, here's two elections, both with the same kind of problems, bottlenecks at the Democratic popular precincts, anomalies in the electronic tabulation of the data, problems with this ballot marking, deviations from the exit polls, statistically highly improbable deviations, both benefited the same guy, George W. Bush, and yet we don't think of those as serial crimes. Yeah, somebody's just said I do. 9/11, we're looking at the events of 9/11, but we tend to not think of 9/11 as connected to the anthrax letter attacks. Now, even that's true, even though we first thought they came from the same source. But now we think, oh no, one of them was the crazed Bruce Ivins, and the other was the terrorist. That's how a lot of people tend to think about it. I call this incident-specific myopia. So it's a nearsightedness. I think of it as driven, we're like abuse victims. These shocking events are so overwhelming, they loom large in our minds, in our perceptions, and we can't see them as if we were above and looking at a bunch of them. We can only just see the one and then see the other. I worked with a PhD student about 15 years ago. We interviewed abuse victims, spouse abuse victims. And one of the strangest things to me was that they didn't see patterns in the abuse. Women would say, he kicked me and shut me down the stairs. Yeah, he threw the spaghetti in my face. But you said, God, this guy's a maniac. No, dinner was late. So I think to some extent this myopia is abuse of response. So I don't mean to accuse us of being stupid or foolish or something like that. I think that there are reasons for this. But it is the opposite of the way we think about most crimes. If there was a man who married a wealthy woman and the woman died of a freak accident, and then he married another wealthy woman, and she died of a freak accident, we would say, this guy's killing his wives. We would certainly suspect that. We would interrogate him. We would want to know, where were you when she died from the freak accident? It would be our automatic response. The TV shows on crime use this constantly. They will look for patterns in crimes to identify the suspect. It's just a normal thing. It's criminology 101. And yet when we look at elite political crimes, we see them one at a time. Even when there are obvious connections, like the Kennedy assassinations or the 2000 and 2004 elections. Why do we do that? Well, I mentioned part of it is the abuse syndrome. Part of it, there's just powerful norms that prevent us from suspecting it. The fact is the political class ostracizes anybody who says these things. If you're an elite, good luck, you're going to have not many friends. If you're not an elite, good luck, you're probably going to lose your job or be shunned in other ways. The clearest example of these norms is the conspiracy theory label and how it operates. You know, what's so peculiar about the conspiracy theory label is it doesn't make any sense. Okay, the idea of conspiracy being an irrational belief, the idea of conspiracy is a sound legal concept. We use it all the time. We prosecute gangsters in the United States for conspiring. We have a RICO Act. It's about conspiracies. Conspiracies happen. You know that. Iran-Contra, Watergate. So how can you have a concept that dismisses all conspiracies as improbable or impossible? It doesn't make any sense. And yet we do it. Not us. People who criticize us. It's an un-American concept. You might say, Americans really trust their leaders. Actually, no. Americans have a long tradition of distrust of their leaders. And if you go look at the Declaration of Independence, you will see that it is a conspiracy theory. Yes, we're used to looking at the first few sentences to talk about inalienable rights. But if you read the whole thing, the bulk of it is devoted to explaining that King George is plotting to deprive us of our freedoms and liberties. And we prove this by showing a set of things that evince his tyrannical design. Things like making us pay a tea tax and citing Indian attacks and slave rebellions. We go through this long list and we say, see, he's plotting against us, and that's why we have the right to overthrow him. So the notion that conspiracy theory is American is wrong. It's totally foreign to our civil culture. It also doesn't make any sense. It's an unsubstantiated theory of its own. When people dismiss conspiracy theories, what they're doing is embracing a coincidence theory. They're assuming that all these things, they didn't catch the hijackers getting on the planes, and there was a group of elites who said we needed to have a new Pearl Harbor. And there were all these war games going on at the time. And the building stone, all coincidental. All coincidence is something. What's going on is you have an unsubstantiated theory that's being smuggled in with this pejorative term. And finally, it's based on a false premise. This idea that someone would talk, Americans know you can keep secrets. We kept the Manhattan Project secret. That had 100,000 people working on it. They built three cities from scratch. One was the fifth largest city in Tennessee. This word never got out. Get this, when Truman became president, he was not told about the Manhattan Project until he had been in office for over a week. So we can keep secrets. We kept secret the decoding of the Japanese and German secret codes. That was kept secret all through the war. The idea that you can't keep secrets among large groups of people is just mistaken. We have done it. Where did it come from? Why are we, if it's such a, it's a nonsensical and un-America and smuggles in unsubstantiated theories and is contrary to fact, where did it come from? Well, the reality is part of the pejorative association with the idea of conspiracies came from the CIA. There was a program, a public information campaign that the CIA launched in 1967 against critics of the Warren Commission. This is a copy of a document that was released in 1976 through a Freedom of Information Act request that talks about countering these critics. This dispatch came out in 1967. And what it told the CIA officers to do is contact their media assets. These were friendly editorial writers and politicians. Tap those and tell them that anybody that criticizes the Warren Commission is assuming there's a conspiracy. All the accounts they could put together in that one catchphrase. They also said that it looked like this conspiracy talk, that was the term they used, the conspiracy talk was coming from communist propagandists. Now this is in the Cold War. This is a real smear that they're putting on people who are criticizing the Warren Commission. Recently, we have a proposal for cognitive infiltration. Dr. Griffin has written about this, and I recommend his work. One of the men who wrote the article, these are Harvard law professors, and Cass Sunstein is now in the Obama administration. And they call for infiltration of conspiracy theory networks and groups to disrupt their dialogue. This is breathtaking hypocrisy. Understand, this is how the state thinks. They are saying they want the government to target citizens because they want these citizens to stop saying that that's what the government does. So it's really Orwellian. If they're inserting concepts, and I think that that may be what is going on, we have good evidence that they inserted the conspiracy theory meme, the conspiracy theory concept. If they're doing that, I think we should be wary of their term, cognitive infiltration. That sounds a little innocent, you know. I'm just kind of looking into what you're thinking. I would call it linguistic thought control or subliminal indoctrination, because they're trying to insert terms into the discourse that bias the reasoning process and the civil society without us being aware of it. They do it all the time when we're aware of it. It's like the war on terror. Somebody coined that term, and some extraordinary rendition, harsh interrogation. They coin these terms all the time, but normally we're aware of it. Axis of evil. We're aware of it. We can defend ourselves against that kind of manipulation of the language. But this cognitive infiltration that they're talking about is where we would be unaware of it, and they would plant these ideas. So I think we should be very, very concerned about it. All right, let's look at SCADs. I've got a list of 19 SCADs. These are political crimes and tragedies. Most are well documented. There are only a few that have been officially corroborated. Watergate, Iran-Contra, Plaingate. It turns out that the only time the government investigates itself, my research suggests, is when you have Congress in control by one party and the executive by another. So we get Watergate, you had a Democratic Congress and a Republican president. You get Iran-Contra, you had a Democratic Congress and a Republican president. Before I go to that, let me just run through these. McCarthyism, that was just somebody making wild accusations to foment social panic and to gain political advantage. The Kennedy assassination, you know about. Oswald assassinated 2 days later in police headquarters on TV. Yeah, it was on TV. That was on TV. But they got the Zapruder film and sequestered that. It wasn't shown publicly until 75. The 1968 October surprise, you may not be familiar with, this was when Lyndon Johnson was trying to make peace in Vietnam. And Richard Nixon, who was running for president, sent word to the South Vietnamese and said, don't participate in the peace talks, I'll get you a better deal. And they withdrew from the peace talks. So there was no, that what the, Nixon was worried about is if they made peace, the Democrats would win. And he committed treason. The guy, this was an act of treason. Johnson found out about it because Johnson had wiretapped the phone in his plane. And Nixon was so incensed by that. He wiretapped me. What a scoundrel. Just a year or so ago, a tape came out, and Lyndon Johnson's holdings that are periodically released, our leads let us learn about these things 50 years after the fact. And a tape came out, and it was Johnson talking to the head of the Republican leadership in the Senate and saying, do you know what Richard Nixon is doing? He's committing treason, and he's undermining my efforts to make peace. And the guy said, yeah, it's awful. We shouldn't be doing that. And he said, well, why don't you talk to him for me? So this comes out that we know this was going on. This is well confirmed. Ellsberg, we got a court case on. And I say burglary, but they stalked the man. They attacked him physically. They tried to discredit him in a variety of ways. Wallace, you might think, well, Wallace, I don't know whether that should count as some of the state was involved in. But I will tell you, Ben Bradley, the editor of the Washington Post, said when he heard about Wallace, this is in Woodward and Bernstein's book, All the President's Men, his first reaction was that was the ultimate dirty trick. Wallace was running as a third party candidate. He was expected to get seven states. That might have made it impossible for Nixon to get a majority in the Electoral College, in which case the election would have gone to Congress, to the House. That was controlled by the Democrats. So it was a real threat to him. So when Wallace got killed, anybody that ran against Nixon, I mean, think about it. John Kennedy was killed. Robert Kennedy was killed in 68 when he won the Democratic nomination. And then Wallace was shot and survived. You know, if you had a woman whose first husband died, sick of the stomach, you would be concerned and feel sorry for him. Second husband died, you would be very concerned. Third husband died, you would exhume the bodies. I think that when we look at these assassinations, the connection to Nixon is pretty alarming.
And Nixon also organized the Warren Commission.
He set it up. And understand, Nixon gets pardoned. We do not know all the crimes of Watergate. Nixon was pardoned for any crimes he might have committed. The logical thing would have been to do is investigate, prosecute, convict, and then pardon if you can't stomach a leader going to jail. But no, we pardoned him in advance. Who pardoned him? The guy who became president when he stepped down. I mean, go figure. The Reagan assassination is something of a stretch, but there are connections between Hinckley and the Bush family. The 1980 October surprise was the effort to keep the hostages from being released before the 1980 election. And Congress investigated that and decided that some of the principals had alibis. These alibis later came into question, but it was after the Congress had investigated. And when they looked at Iran-Contra, they specifically prohibited going back and looking at the 1980 October surprise. You can only look at the new stuff. The 2000 presidential election, I wrote a book on that, and it was just full of shenanigans. 9/11, we're here to talk about the anthrax letter attacks. Wellstone, most of my suspicions about Wellstone's death are circumstantial, but it was a troubling plane crash, and the circumstances and the timing were suspicious. Iraqgate, I'm referring to the manipulation of intelligence to justify the invasion of Iraq. That was a far-flung conspiracy. That involved the Justice Department, there were memos written about it, and the torture. If you go look at when we implemented torture, when we actually harshly interrogated, to use our phrase, it was in the run-up to the Iraq War, to the invasion. It was in the summer of 2001. And what we were doing was looking for bogus evidence of a connection, a confession, linking 9/11 and Iraq. So the Iraq gate, this is a far-flung set of crimes. The 2004 presidential election, you're aware of, You know, there's still litigation going on about that. One of the key witnesses died in a plane crash just not long ago. Very suspicious. And his attorney had claimed that there had been threats on his life. Very suspicious. The last one I have is the bogus terror alerts of 2004. We know about these because Tom Ridge fessed up. The word had leaked out in 2005. But basically what was going on is when the president's approval rating was going down, they would announce a terror attack, a threat, and his approval would go back up. And they did this repeatedly in the run-up to the election. So I had this list of 19. One thing I would point out is how many elections were tainted. Often not by just one of these SCADs, but by two and sometimes three. 64, 68, 72, 80, 2000, 2004. In 64, you had John Kennedy assassinated with Oswald, but then you also had the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Now, this is one thing that goes on with these SCADs. They're done in a political climate. And with the Gulf of Tonkin, this was a provocation and an attack that probably did not occur. Congress was told North Vietnam had attacked our ships. There was no doubt about it. We were in the international waters minding our own business. So this was just complete lying to Congress about the nature of this thing. This was in 1964 in October, in the run-up to the 1964 election, and Goldwater was criticizing Johnson for being soft on the war. And so you suddenly get this congressional resolution authorizing the Vietnam War right before the 64 election. You know, we had a similar thing with the 2002 congressional authorization to go into Iraq. That was pushed through Congress right before the midterm elections in 2002. 68, you had the leading Democrat assassinated and the peace talks subverted. 68, 72, you have Ellsberg's stalking, Wallace shot, and Watergate. Watergate, you know, it's called a burglary. Do you know why it's called a burglary? 3 days after the Watergate people were arrested, Ron Ziegler, the press secretary for Nixon, came out and said, well, this was a third-rate burglary attempt. But it was a wiretapping. They were going back in. They had already wiretapped the offices of the Democratic National Party, and one of the wiretaps had quit working, so they were going back in to fix it when they got caught. So they called it a burglary. Well, it was a lot more than that, and there were a whole lot of these dirty tricks. What Nixon was doing was making sure whoever he was running against would be the weakest candidate. So the governor gets the nomination. He picks as his vice president, Eagleton, who's had electroshock therapy. So it kind of did in his whole campaign. 1980, 2000, 2004, you're familiar with. So this is just on the face of it. I think one thing Americans don't do is just look at all the suspicious events that we have. Just lay them on the table and look at them all at once, as opposed to one by one. That's half of the presidential elections.
And again, you were just listening to Lance DeHaven Smith at the Toronto hearings in September. Tune in next week to hear the second and final part of that speech. And now for the events. On Saturday, November 19th, beginning at noon, and on Sunday, November 20th, there'll be an Occupy Building 7 event in New York City. For more information on how to participate, the website is OccupyBuilding7.org. And on Saturday, December 3rd, Barbara Honegger, former government official in the Reagan administration and author of the book The October Surprise, will be speaking at the University of Hartford in the Auerbach Auditorium at 7 p.m. Barbara Honegger will be sharing her extensive research on what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11. For more information, you can call 860-919-4042. That's 860-919-4042. And if you want to help the Occupy Hartford folks, their website is OccupyHartfordCT.com. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.